For years, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had adamantly denied the existence of the Mafia after a fateful meeting in upstate New York in mid-November 1957. He could no longer do so. Gil Revel writes about this Mafia Summit in his new book, Mafia Summit, J. Edgar Hoover, the Kennedy Brothers, and the Meeting That Unmasked the Mob. The book is published by Thomas Dunn Books, and it's a pleasure to welcome Gil Revel to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
What brought you to this particular summit?
I had a long time interest in this, and the more I looked into it, the more I realized that it was really a pivot point in the history of organized crime in America. And there was this great story at the heart of it, of a single cop, a single state patrol officer, who basically changed the face of both the law enforcement effort against organized crime and the mob itself. The Appalachian Summit was really the Mafia's Waterloo.
Why? Give us a sense of what was brewing to bring this to a head, if you will.
What led up to the Appalachian Summit was a mob war, basically. Vito Genovese had come back from Italy, where he was hiding out from a murder rap, and came back to the States and realized that he was no longer in the top of the hierarchy of the mob. So that was in 1945. So it took him 10 years to sort of eliminate his rivals, worm his way back up to the top. And right before the Appalachian Conference, there was a couple hits. Albert Anastasia, the mob boss of the Brooklyn waterfront, was killed. That was that famous hit in the barbershop of the Park Central Hotel, and also Frank Costello, another mob boss, wasn't there was an assassination attempt that led to his retirement. So Vito Genovese basically cleared the tables, eliminated his rivals, and it was time to sort of declare him the new boss of bosses. So they decided to meet up at Joe Barbera's house up in this little town, Appalachian, New York, right outside of Binghamton.
What was it about Joe Barbera's house that became the spot?
Well, it was in the right mob boss's territory. Stephen Magadino of Buffalo was Barbera's boss. And Magadino felt that he was owed a little respect from the mob. He was sort of the entry point for a lot of the smuggling that went on, especially the smuggling of heroin during the 50s. He was racking up a lot of profits from that, and he felt that he was owed a plum. And this meeting was a plum for Stephen Magadino. Joe Barbera was one of his soldiers. He had a 58-acre estate on a hilltop above the Susquehanna River. It was a beautiful place, a stone ranch house. It wasn't palatial by any means, but it was a good place to meet away from prying eyes, or so they thought. And it had a brand new, spanking new barbecue. And the mob are big meat eaters, and so Joe Barbera laid on a spread for him.
It seems as though that you would think that this would be something that had been in the works for a long time, but really you come to the understanding that it all happened very quickly, really.
Right. Albert Anastasia had only been assassinated 2 weeks before, and from phone records, we see that there was really furious organization going on, people calling back and forth, getting their ducks lined up, and sending out the invitations. And the mobsters came from all over the country. There were people from Los Angeles, people from Chicago, Illinois, Cleveland, Dallas, New Orleans. It was the top hierarchy of the mob at that time.
At the beginning of the book, there is a cast of characters. It is broken into two groups, government and, of course, organized crime. And what is fascinating about that is it's a who's who on both sides, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. This did involve some from top people, both in law enforcement and the mob. All the bosses of the five families came, Vito Genovese, Joe Bonanno, Joe Profaci, Carlo Gambino, who is going to take over Albert Anastasia's Brooklyn territory. Tommy Lucchese came. He came late, luckily, saw the police roadblocks and split. But all five bosses of the families and other people like Paul Castellano and Sam Giacana. This is really the top leadership spectrum of the mob, and they were meeting for several different reasons, not only to ordain Vito Genovese as the boss of bosses, but for other reasons about heroin smuggling, policies towards heroin. Cuba was a big issue, so they needed to meet.
As far as the meeting itself, when did all hell start to break loose? What caused that? It was ultimately when law enforcement started to descend on the space, but what caused that?
Well, the meeting ended very soon after it began. State Police Detective Edgar Croswell rolled up to the place at 12:30. The last mob boss came at around noon, so they only had about a half hour without any police presence at all. It's an interesting story that Edgar Croswell had been watching Joe Barbera for over 10 years at this point in time. Joe Barbera was masquerading as a legitimate businessman. He owned the local Canada Dry bottling plant in Endicott, which is right outside of Binghamton. And he presented this facade to the world that he was simply a man that was totally legitimate. But Edgar Croswell thought differently. He looked into his past, saw that he had beaten a succession of murder raps, had all sorts of unsavory connections to the New York mob. So Edgar Croswell, this was really a lonely vigil. He would drive up to Joe Barbera's house, Hilltop House, maybe once or twice a month for 10 years, just keeping an eye on it and knowing that he had really one mobbed up guy within his territory. So when he did this in November of 57, he drove up to the house and saw dozens of large limousines, Cadillacs, Lincolns, Chrysler Imperials, just these gorgeous, gorgeous top luxury cars that didn't really have any business being in anywhere in, backwoods upstate New York. And he realized that something was going on. He set up a roadblock, and that triggered the mobsters' flight. Some of them fled into the woods. Some of them tried to drive out.
No blood was shed. There was only one warning shot fired. There were, of course, legal charges. Most of those were reversed upon appeal. There were some perjury raps, some contempt of court jailings. But ultimately, it really didn't end up in being this mass arrest or certainly putting an end to anything. But as you write in the book, the one thing that it did for the mafia was their least favorite thing, which was give them publicity.
That's right. I say in the book that as a bust, this was something of a bust. There was no arrest. They weren't doing anything wrong. They were just detained. But the repercussions were enormous. For one thing, there were two really vital consequences from Apalachin. One was that Robert F. Kennedy put the mob in his sights and conducted a legal assault on the mafia. Not only he was the chief counsel of the Senate Rackets Committee at the time of the summit, and then later on he became the attorney general in his brother's administration. And he conducted a really intense campaign against the leadership of the mafia. And so that was one of the consequences. And the other consequences is really interesting because it had really, really far-reaching results, was the development of RICO conspiracy legislation. RICO is a Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act. And what it does is people had this sense after Apalachin was, well, can't you arrest them for something? They had all these top mob guys in one place, and all the legal cases against them petered out, basically. And it just didn't make sense that you couldn't arrest a mob boss that might not actually pull the trigger, but would order a murder to be done. Directly flowing from Apalachin was the development of RICO conspiracy legislation, which it took a little while. It wasn't until the 1980s, really, that it really resulted in a lot of mob convictions. But that those two consequences, Robert F. Kennedy and RICO, eventually worked to really snap the spine of the American mob, dismantling this classic national leadership structure that had reigned over America for really a quarter century.
As I mentioned, the subtitle of the book is J. Edgar Hoover, the Kennedy Brothers, and the Meeting That Unmasked the Mob. Obviously, Hoover and the Kennedys play a large part in this story because this is all going on while they're political life is very much in gear.
Exactly so. You know, in the beginning, the Kennedy brothers, Bobby was Jack's consigliere, for lack of a better term, and he was his campaign manager. And they understood that anti-mob legislation and anti-mob activity by the government was a good campaign issue that they could use to successfully promote Jack's candidacy. That's how it started out. But something funny happened on the way to the White House. Bobby Kennedy actually adopted this cause as his own, and it became a really heartfelt issue for him. He was very interested, as we know, in social justice, and he saw this issue, this anti-mob issue, as a social justice issue, really, because it was the strong exploiting the weak, and he had this visceral sense of being offended by that, and he really took on the mob in his days as Attorney General, so that. You know, that triggered, Apalachin triggered that assault that Bobby Kennedy conducted.
Ultimately, with this incredible summit and the unmasking of the mob, as you call it in the book, what ultimately is the story we should take away from what happened on that day?
Well, there's one image that everybody remembers. It's the image of these big city mobsters dressed impeccably in their sharkskin suits and their pointy toes, leather Italian shoes, and they're fleeing into the woods and they're slipping, sliding. It was a rainy day. It was a miserable day to be bushwhacking. And that image somehow really seizes the public imagination. Billy Crystal in the movie analyzed this used it. That's how that movie opens. And it's that, it's sort of the city mouse in the country image that, that people really love. But beyond that, there's this image or this sense of the arrogance of the mobsters, for one thing. They thought they were untouchable. They didn't think that anybody could interfere with their grip on organized crime. And here's this single heroic, I really think he's an American hero, this single state police detective that wound up upsetting their apple cart. And the other thing also is the hubris of government, because J. Edgar Hoover had this sense and a repeated conviction that there was no such thing as the mafia. He said it again and again. And it's hard to remember now, or it's hard to imagine now, I mean, after the Godfather movies, and after the RICO bus of the 1980s, and that in the 1950s, there was a lot of people that really didn't believe that there was such a thing as the mafia. It hadn't been exposed, and Hoover was the top cop, and there was a lot more respect for authority in those days. And so he was saying again and again, there is no mafia. He used to call it baloney. He had his eyes focused on the communist menace, and he couldn't spare another eye for the mafia. So those two things, it's a story of arrogance on the part of the mob and arrogance on part of the government.
The name of the book is Mafia Summit: J. Edgar Hoover, the Kennedy Brothers, and the Meeting That Unmasked the Mob. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Gil Revel, I thank you very much for spending time and sharing the story with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Mafia Summit, published by Thomas Dunn Books from St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.